Welcome back, folks, to episode 60 of the Running Man Self-Regulation Skills and Self-Improvement Project podcast with me, your host, Dr. Armando Dominguez, PhD in health psychology, licensed professional counselor, and an adjunct professor at a local community college. And what we're going to be discussing today is something right along the lines of my personal nerddom, and we're going to pull out some research and discuss some things having to do with self-regulatory skills. So where we're going to start the discussion is going to be with the cerebral blood flow. And in this study that I'm looking at, it was called an analysis of regional cerebral blood flow in impulsive murderers using single photon emission computed tomography. So basically, they were doing a PET scan to determine where the active areas were occurring when this study was done. And what they were trying to do was incite an anger response in a population of men, normal, healthy men, and also men that had been implicated in actual murder and known for impulsivity in their crime. So the reason I'm pointing this out is that we're looking at two extremes, because most of us fall within the very normal, general range of healthy as far as how we respond emotionally and physically towards things. And self-regulatory skills are things that are useful to all people of all ages and also in many different professions. And speaking to business owners, also with people that actually do therapy like myself, talking with clients, and folks that do dangerous jobs such as oil field work or work with things like measuring gases coming out of the ground if they're doing oil field support type network work, or even things that have to do with health and training. Knowing the inside of oneself and knowing how we react to stress, our stressors perceived, whether it be professionally or even within the social network when we're interacting with folks, or when we're going to even take a test for that matter. And these are times that we could call peak need events, where we have to know how to regulate ourselves and our emotions and not let ourselves fall into the anxiety-ridden states that are uncomfortable. But also, we have to recognize that whenever we're looking at this study, the murders, they were the extreme. Whenever we talk about extremes and use of tools, if they work for people in these realms, then by default, that means within the healthier realms, they would work even more effectively. And that is a jump in reasoning, but it's also one that I've, in practice, been able to note myself and in clinical sessions, been able to note that they work within a safe environment, but also in the real life situations, people, students of mine, also people that I've trained, and in myself, noted that whenever real life happens, wherever it's danger to self or potential danger to self, or maybe others are getting to that point where they could become dangerous or potentially suddenly violent and these tools work, then that says that those tools are probably very useful. These are the things that I teach within the podcast of the self-regulation skills of the running man himself. And the reason I'm prefacing what we're going to be talking about is because there are certain things that we have to look at as far as what running man model teaches, and that is a model that is not at the most atomistic and smallest of structure levels, where we're talking about neurotransmitters and receivers and transport modalities within certain structures. Those are working within there, but for our intents and purposes, to make it useful to me, make it useful to what I am doing as a person interacting at the human interface level, then we have to kind of zoom out a little bit. And if we pay attention more to the larger symptomology of what stress does to me and anxiety and how I respond to my environment, then that's where we start looking at what things are more useful and practical, and by having an understanding at a slightly deeper level, not only symptomology, but what drives it, then we start gaining not only insight, but ability to actually use time to our benefit, or we may be able to suspend certain things by catching things early. And this is where, in quotes, timing is everything. Timing makes you the most powerful, and timing makes you fast, even though you may be physically slow. By being in the right place at the right time, just a little early, and you can, in essence, take advantage of that opportunity, that positioning. And when it comes to regulating emotions and physical states, this is incredibly powerful, but absolutely useful. I rarely speak in absolutes, but this is one that comes close to it. And let us go and start the discussion. So the discussion, once again, has to do with the cerebral blood flow and impulsive type folks. And we're discussing impulse. In this study, what they wound up doing was showing emotionally charged pictures, images of faces that were exhibiting fear and also sadness. And in those folks that were in the realm of what they called healthy males, and strangely, they had right-handed males, and they made a point of identifying that, which was really kind of cool, and may have to do with activity on the right half of the brain being more active in somebody that's, let's say, it's more left-handed, that we tend to note as being more autistic and also more spatial and this sort of stuff. So they had healthy males, and their age ranges were from as low as 18 up into 30 were the younger people that were partitioned, and then they had from 30 on up to 71. It was 17 at the youngest, rather, on up to 30, and then they divided them from 30 above 30 to age 71. So there was quite a range in age there, but yet whenever they divided those, they divided them between those that had been implicated in impulsive criminal activity up to murder, and then those that didn't have such things, but yet there were those that had lesser charges, some that had maybe pre-existing diagnoses of mental illnesses, two of them actually, three out of a total of 27, which isn't a great deal of percentage within the whole of the people. I think there were 27 in the study, a smaller study, but yet pretty effective in giving us an idea that within a certain population that is small to start with, then we see a greater degree of effect of mental illness. Not saying mental illness makes you a criminal, not even jumping there, but just clearing that up right away. That's not any part of that. That's just how they structured the study, and also that just happened to be the people they were working with and that they were able to get. So the next thing is that whenever they were looking at these emotionally charged images, those folks that fell within the healthy range, that did not have a history of impulsiveness or aggression that was impulse-driven, they tended to respond to those cues, and they had certain areas of brain that were active. And they differentiated two axes of areas that were, for the most part, activated during the fear response, and also one that was the anger response. And the structures, I believe, that they had for the fear pathway, I'm looking at my notes here, were the prefrontal orbital structure and the striatum with those that were within the healthy range. And with the anger pathway, with those that were beyond the healthy and more in the extreme range, it was the prefrontal orbital structure, also the area of the anterior cingulate cortex. And the reason I mention these is that the two pathways, the one that was more fear-based versus the one that is more anger-based, were what they were actually looking at. And what they were paying attention to were what they called disaffected responses. They weren't, rather, paying attention to disaffected responses, responses that were not driven by emotion, fear, emotion, anger. And those were the two that they were keying on. And by saying disaffected, that means that there are certain actions that they were paying attention to, impulsivity and violence and aggression, that had its two primary drivers as either fear, if it's a defensive aggression that may be displayed, versus one that is an anger-born aggression that is more instrumental in a sense, and happened to appear more in those that were not only violent but had also murdered. So we're talking, once again, an extreme. So how does this serve us as far as Running Man self-regulation skills and self-improvement? Two is identifying that the structures that were activated are things that are shared by all human beings at all levels of health and capacity, with history of impulsivity or not. We have these. Now, one thing that was noted that had to do not only with blood flow, But with the structures that were being activated, they noted that within the people that were more impulsive or driven by anger to impulse and aggression and acting out on that had a lower level of serotonin receptor activity. Not just blood flow, but lower level neurotransmitter activity, which means that they were actually less apt to self-regulate. Whenever the anger would come up, the potential for them to self-regulate was a lot lower. So that means the power to self-regulate was weaker, so to speak. And the study says that this behavior of self-regulation was attenuated in those that were more impulsive due to anger. So what does that say? That means that we do have a greater degree of potential capacity to self-regulate whenever we're within the healthier range and don't have a history of impulsivity. So there is a structure there that is either shaped by our conditioning from our environment, and we talked about environmental pressure and how we respond, not only at the thinking level and how we perceive it, but also how we experience it and how our body adapts. But also, these structures, if there is ever any physical damage due to a head injury, head injuries, or anything along the lines of anoxia, where you didn't have enough oxygen, or may have passed out as a result of that, or maybe you wound up having some sort of stroke or some sort of cerebral event or cardiovascular event that limited the amount of blood flow carrying oxygen that could have caused damage or what's called a lesion. Now, why is this important? As a result of those things, that's actual physical, what we would call pathological damage. That doesn't make you pathological in the way it's thrown around in the common sense. But pathology is something that's not only measurable, but it's something that changes a structure as a result of it occurring, whatever event that is, that creates damage. So lesion is damage, but it's also one that may be healed up as a result of having had said damage, but also there's an impact. Sometimes that can affect whatever it is that we're calling our output, our best thinking when we're talking about the brain itself in particular, as a result of head injury or blood flow shift, this sort of thing, or a lack of oxygen. So keeping those things in mind, within the healthy population, those people that do not struggle in particular with impulsivity and self-control, why is this important? Well, it really helps us elucidate and have some insight into what happens to us, because we can all get reduced down to our most animal basic primordial selves whenever we get the right amount of pressure put on us, if we experience something traumatic, something shocking, something very sudden. And this is something that they noted, that on presentation of stimulus, depending on how fast it was, that the folks that had impulsivity issues generally did not respond to things. It was like zero blip on the radar if it wasn't emotionally laden. If it wasn't emotional, there was no threat. And that's really what it is that they were noting, is that if things weren't seen as emotionally charged or threatening, it wasn't enough for those that were impulsive by nature to respond to it. And this is where I have to qualify a little bit of what was being said in this study, in that they actually had to separate out people that were predatory in nature, wherever they were doing things in a predatory sense or using the emotional response versus not having an emotional response because they were trying to instrumentally set things up, which means that was premeditation and calculation. That falls within the realm of sociopathy and psychopathy, but also that also means that these are disaffected behaviors. It's not driven by anger or driven by fear. And those can be some pretty scary things when we really look deeply into it. But for the purposes of what we're talking about, self-regulation, we're talking about those that are still able to respond with some said emotion and may be driven by emotion to either impulse to aggress or to be violent, or out of impulse have to be aggressive out of self-protection necessity. So here's the next part. The blood flow shifted during stress. And during the time they did the PET scans, they were noting that the areas of activity where blood sugar was being metabolized in those areas, they lit up as a result of what it is that they were presenting those people in the study with, and those were the emotional images of people exhibiting anger on their face or even sadness on their face, those that were not impulsive responded rather strongly to those things, and they had emotional charge as a result of that, but there was not necessarily any impulsive action wanted to be taken, but the anger was noted. And there are also those areas that have to do with self-control that lit up. Those are the areas that are structured to give us a sense of control whenever things feel like they're out of control. And within the healthy population, these things lit up. These areas, similarly, in those that were impulsive and violent, as noted in their history, did not have these areas light up. Actually, the areas that had to do with more perceptual, the occipital range in the back with the vision and action, the motor cortical areas were more active. That means what they were seeing, they were interpreting very quickly. Even if they didn't understand what was going on or couldn't interpret it correctly as far as like a social cue, is it for real? Are they acting tough or are they really trying to hurt me? This sort of thing. They were unable to interpret facial body language and social cues as much. They weren't able to essentially do what we do when we're doing the get along to get along at the social level, being able to tell if somebody is bullshitting us or if someone is really being honest with us and authentic. They couldn't tell the difference. So the higher level of stress, the more sudden the presentation of the stimuli, the more apt the impulsive, historically impulsive people were to act out in an impulsive, aggressive manner and in a very quick way. Whereas those that didn't have that history of aggressive, violent impulsivity were able to interpret those cues and were less apt to impulsively act or move towards violence, is what the speculative thoughts were in the study. And I agree with this based on my experience. I'm not saying this is the end-all, be-all. It is a study, but it's one of many that kind of reflect very similar ideas and have similar results. And oh, I just want to share this with y'all because it's a very important thing that if on a day-to-day we're not always dealing with anger or aggression or environmental threat, we are still making sense of our environment and interpreting whether or not things are safe, whether I can do something or not, and determining whether or not somebody or something is potentially threatening or is apt to move to violence, especially if we have a history of knowing how people act. And this is where the most important parts of what I teach have to do with interpreting body language and knowing that communication occurs before the verbal ever starts. We're interpreting not only the space, but how somebody moves. And these are body language things. These are body cues. And are they social cues? In a sense, because often people project their intent by way of how they move through their world and how we interact with them as well. And we do the same. And people size us up moment to moment every day. As soon as we walk into a convenience store or into a large shopping center, we're always being sized up, not by one, but many. Some just become a little more obvious at doing it. But those that are really good, you'll never know they're sizing you up. And these are things we have to pay attention to just to be able to improve our own control in our environment in the sense of feeling safe and doing the best we can to meet our own assumption of safety when we're out alone. And knowing when that assumption of safety is wavering on being broken or becoming something along the lines of an environmental factor that says, let's get out of here. So important stuff to pay attention to. So I had to pull out the nerd today, and I really enjoyed reading that study. But it was also a reminder of what I do with this podcast, and that's teaching self-regulatory skills, not just because we are lacking them, but many people need to know, well, how do I do this? And much of the how-to I provide in the podcast, because this stuff isn't something you just automatically get. You don't just observe and get the skills. You can get the skills on the outside, but still lack the understanding on the inside. And we need to have both to be more effective and also run the risk of always doing this in a sense that we increase our sense of comfort when we're moving about our world and our sense of aplomb when we're doing things. And self-regulatory skills don't just apply to my environment and being safe and preventing violence or aggression, but also has to do with how I interpret a task. How well can I do when I'm testing? How can I keep my heart rate at a level that I feel uncomfortable, rather comfortable and not uncomfortable to where it feels like my heart is jumping out of my chest? So this is really what the self-regulatory skills are about mostly, but they should also be rather applicable to real-world potential danger to my physical self. And whenever we have that ironed out, everything else, the academic and the social, they're so much easier to deal with. Because if we can use this whenever our body's being stressed or threatened, we can definitely do it. And there is transfer of training, mind you, moving it from the physical to the intellectual and also the social realms. And doing it effectively, we'll be able to do our things much more easily with much more ease and sense of comfort and self efficacy, if you will, and we'll gain skill. So that being said, I just want to share this once again. I think it was a small study, but a very, very pertinent one. Once again, the blood flow that affects the front part of the brain, it moves away and goes to the skeletal muscles as a default when we stress, impacts our thinking, but it also impacts the development of our neurotransmitter receptors based on stress, whatever stress we're having. And the areas that light up have a lot to do with what we're wired to do to encourage our survival in a bigger sense. So these are really our inheritance. These are our gifts from our ancestors, and they're continually growing and changing and adapting. But knowing that we have these helps us have not only understanding, but also recognize that we have the potential to learn and shape how we do moving forward. Just because you've had an impulsive way of doing things doesn't mean you can't shape or change that. Whenever there is severe pathology, there are certain limitations that behavioral skills and medications may help, and I'm not condoning taking meds for the sake of control. Not saying that, but there are those that need that to help regulate not only the thought, but the impulsivity, because it is beyond the ability to cognitively correct. The behavioral generally works pretty well. So for today, I want to say thank you for spending some time with me this Sunday afternoon. And just giving a shout out to all those that are actually working these self-regulatory skills. And I'm just really thankful that you are listening. Please share the podcast with people that you think may benefit from it. And it doesn't have to do with just mental health and mental wellness, but physical health and fitness. Health and fitness. You can use it in the martial arts and sport. But on top of that, you can use it in business. You can use it in business interaction and communication as well. And even in your most personal personals, hanging out and talking with your kids works at that level too. So that being the case, if you have any feedback for me, please send it to the email at getskillsproject@gmail.com. And I hope to hear from you. Take care of yourself. Walk well.